Hi, it's Diane. On my mind is Russia preparing to invade Ukraine. That question has taken on a new urgency as intelligence reports reveal a buildup of thousands of troops along the Russia-Ukraine border. Though Russian President Vladimir Putin denies imminent action, the threat has led to a flurry of diplomatic activity. On Tuesday, President Biden met with Putin in a two-hour video call. On Thursday, he spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as NATO allies. Ivo Dalder is president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and served as U.S. ambassador to NATO from May 2009 to July 2013. I spoke with him Friday afternoon about why Ukraine is so important to Russia, what this means for European security, and the role of the U.S. Ivo, give us some background on this growing tension between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine.
Well, it depends a little bit how far back you want to go. If you want to believe Vladimir Putin's interpretation of history and national consciousness, you got to go back 300-400 years in which Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, was the origins of the Russian state and the Russian how the Russians thought about themselves. But the real crisis goes back, to the breakup of the Soviet Union, which Vladimir Putin described as the greatest calamity, a catastrophe of the 20th century, in which Ukraine, a major part of the Soviet Union, the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, and a major source of manufacturing industries, rocket factories for rockets of the Soviet Union, became an independent state back in 1991 when the Soviet Union broke up. For a long time, particularly Vladimir Putin has looked at Ukraine, Belarus to some extent, one or two other former Soviet republics as essentially part of Russia. And even though they are formerly independent states, he has always believed that in its essence, they need to be under the control of Moscow, whether directly by being integrated in Russia and a single state, or at least controlled politically, that what happens in these countries happens with both the voice of Moscow and, if necessary, the veto. So that's the background. Ukraine has, in the 30 years that it has been independent, gone through a whole variety of political changes, both good and bad. You may remember some 15, 20 years ago, there was the Orange Revolution, demand for democracy, and there was a big political confrontation about 8 years ago in late 2013 and 2014 when a Russian-aligned leader was resisting demands for change from his population. He was ousted he fled as the result of a popular uprising. And there was the worry that the new Ukraine would align even more closely to the West, to NATO, to the European Union. At that point, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine, annexed Crimea, and supported a separatist movement in eastern Ukraine. And that's where it's been. And that separatist movement, by the way, for the last 8 years, there's been constant fighting. About 14,000 Ukrainians have lost their lives. And in this year, first in April and now again in October, massive troop concentrations on Ukraine's border appeared.
We really don't know how many there are, but some have estimated he may take it up, that is, Putin may take that troop level up to something like 175,000, correct?
Yeah, there was a leaked intelligence report in the Washington Post about a week ago where the estimate was that around 75,000 troops are now arraigned around the northern, eastern, and southern borders of Ukraine, with plans for about 100,000 additional troops to be sent to the front, and all the equipment, the tanks, the artillery, the field hospitals, the airplanes. In fact, airplanes in the area are already more than Ukraine deploys in the entire country, ready for the possibility of an invasion. And my conversation with people in the administration, and I think the demonstration we've seen from the administration, is they are deeply, deeply concerned that this is not fake, this is real.
So on Tuesday, President Biden spoke with Vladimir Putin. Yesterday, he had a conversation with the leader of Ukraine. First, talk about his conversation with Putin and what you believe came out of that.
So what we know that that happened in the conversation really was made public by Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, in a press briefing shortly after that conversation. He painted a picture of President Biden in essence telling Putin there's two roads we can go down. You choose. One road is you take military action against Ukraine. And in that case, we're going to take some very, very serious steps. We're going to impose sanctions of the kind that you have never seen before, that we did not impose after 2014, much more significant. The focus seems to be on those sanctions, particularly on Russia's capacity to take part in the international financial system, and particularly with regard to the dollar, euros, and pound sterling, and the inability to transact in those currencies, which it would be a major blow to Russia's capacity to interact with the world. Secondly, Biden said, if you do that, we're gonna turn up the spigot in terms of arms and materiel that we're gonna send to Ukraine, not U.S. soldiers, not NATO soldiers, but we're going to provide Ukraine with what it needs to defend itself, because it needs to be able to defend itself. And third, we're going to build up the U.S. presence in Eastern Europe on NATO territory. And if you are concerned about what the presence there now, well, wait till what happens after you invade.
Okay.
So that was road one. But he also said there's a different road. We can go a diplomatic road. If you don't invade and if you pull back your troops, then, and here there's less clarity, but what we seem to have said is, one is we would like to reinvigorate and help reinvigorate the peace process between you and Ukraine. This is known as the Minsk process, which was an agreement agreed in 2014 and again modified in 2015. Between Russia, Ukraine, with the support of Germany and France, and to try to reinvigorate it, presumably by the U.S. being more directly involved than it was in the negotiation of those agreements. And this is important, he said, we can also, you know, I know you have concerns about the future of European security. Well, we can have a conversation about that too. We had that during the Cold War. Indeed, the 1975 Helsinki Final Act was a discussion that happened between the Soviet Union and the United States, between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, that set out a whole set of principles about, including the principle that you don't change borders by force, and human rights principles that actually may have helped produce the end of the Cold War. So we're willing to do that. And so you choose. We can go down a confrontation path or a diplomacy path, but it's up to you. That's my understanding that came out of that meeting.
I want to go back to the issue of support for sanctions. Does the U.S. have Europe's support, other countries' support for those sanctions against Russia?
So they definitely have support from Britain. Britain has been very, very tough on this, and they're very much aligned with the United States. In the past few weeks, U.S. officials, the highest level, President Biden himself, in conversations with his counterparts in France, Britain, Germany, and Italy, both before and after the meeting with Putin, has had conversations. We've had conversations with the European Union. One very senior official, EU official I talked to the other day said, the Americans have come with a very forceful demand that the EU join the United States in all these financial sanctions. My understanding is that no decision has been made by the European Union, but they are putting together a package of measures that is similar to the package that the United States has, and that the basic mood is this is such a game-altering step if an invasion happens that taking these economic measures is absolutely necessary. So there's quiet confidence, I think, in Washington that there will be an alignment on these issues very soon after this were to happen.
Then yesterday, he talked with Ukraine's leader, and out of that came a rumor reported by the Associated Press that the president talked with Ukraine's leader, asking whether he would be willing to cede some territory to Russia. No truth to that, or could that have been brought up?
I don't see any way in which that would have been brought up. There is one very consistent theme. By the way, the readout from the Ukrainians themselves underscored that, is Biden's, and indeed the U.S. and European, unwavering support for the territorial integrity, independence, and sovereignty of Ukraine. No one has ever recognized Crimea's annexation, and that's not going to happen. It would be stupefying if Biden had raised the possibility of ceding territory. And he knows this issue extremely well. As vice president, President Obama had asked Vice President Biden to take the lead on this issue. He traveled 7 times to Ukraine in that period in order to express his support. Even after I was left government, I have had conversations with the then vice president himself on this issue. I've also had it since he left office. I haven't talked to him since. And his view, both of the threat that Russia represents and the support that we need to give to Ukraine, is unwavering. So I find that not credible.
The other major issue here is that Russia does not want Ukraine to become a member of NATO. And they've been waiting quite a while. How much does that figure into perhaps the conversations between Putin and Biden and Biden and Ukraine?
So what we know is that in the conversation between Putin and Biden, as the president himself said the other day, is he made very, very, very clear that the decision on whether Ukraine joins NATO is a decision for Ukraine and NATO, not for Russia. And Ukraine, to the extent that Ukraine is more interested in joining NATO, one of the reasons they're more interested in joining NATO is because of Putin's own behavior, because Russia represents a threat to Ukraine. The NATO Secretary General a week ago said exactly the same thing, that Ukraine needs to, that the decision on whether Ukraine becomes a member of NATO is for Ukraine and NATO. Now, a difficulty is this. NATO in 2008, when the Allies were very divided on whether or not to invite Ukraine and Georgia, another former Soviet republic, to join NATO or to start a process of joining NATO, with the United States pushing very hard for its inclusion under President George W. Bush, and the French and Germans in particular saying, too early, we're not ready yet. Out of that confrontation came a compromise that said NATO will not provide it with the mechanisms that would start the process of becoming members of NATO, something called the Membership Action Plan, or MAP. But, so that was what the Germans and the French wanted. But in order to satisfy the U.S. and other allies who wanted Ukraine and Georgia to be members of NATO, they also said, but Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. Unconditional, period. So from 2008 onwards, the Ukrainians and Georgians have said, well, you said we're going to become members of NATO. The question is when. And Putin used that phrase as a pretext for, of course, invading Georgia in 2008. And he has used it as a pretext for his actions to say, listen, we don't want you to become part of NATO. NATO is our enemy. This is our, as he now said, this is a red line for us. The problem, of course, is that Ukraine is an independent country.
And the fact is that if Ukraine were to become a member of NATO and Ukraine were attacked by Russia, all of the members of NATO would be called on to come to Ukraine's defense.
Yes, exactly. That's the issue. The issue is before you decide that a country should become a member of the NATO alliance, you better be prepared as a member of that NATO alliance to defend that country in case it is attacked. Because that's the core of what NATO is about. It's Article 5, the commitment that says an attack against one is an attack against all. And so Ukraine membership in NATO means that if it were to be attacked, all NATO members would be committed to defending it. And frankly, the reality is not all NATO members are willing to make that commitment, which is why—
Not even the United States.
Well, the United States has said that because Ukraine is not a member of NATO, we will not send our own forces. And President Biden has just reiterated that the other day. I do think that there are many people, and I wouldn't be surprised if President Biden is one of them in the end, who say, actually, we think that the best way to prevent Russia from ever attacking Ukraine is for them to be a member of NATO, because by attacking Ukraine, they will be attacking NATO, including the United States, and that they wouldn't do. But there's no agreement on that among the 30 allies in Europe. And as a result, the decision to allow you to invite Ukraine to become a member has not been made. And frankly, I don't think is likely to be made, except if Putin continues to do what he does.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Ivo Dalder.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Ivo Dalder. He's president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and was U.S. ambassador to NATO from May 2009 to July 2013. Now let's move to President Biden's conversation with Ukraine's leader. What went on there?
Again, all we know is what has been read out from those meetings, as they say, both in Ukraine and in Washington. And I think the attempt here, remember Secretary of State Blinken also had a conversation with President Zelensky before the Biden-Putin meeting and then this conversation just the other day, Biden reassuring President Zelensky that his conversation with Putin was exactly as I portrayed it, that He made it very clear that any military action against Ukraine would lead to a series of retaliatory steps, sanctions, providing military equipment to Ukraine, and more U.S. troops in NATO that hopefully wouldn't work. And at the same time say, but there's a diplomatic path, and wanting to presumably hear from President Zelensky what his interest in a diplomatic path was. And interestingly enough, Ukraine has always said, of course, the future of Ukraine cannot be decided without Ukraine at the table, which strikes me as a reasonable proposition. But President Zelensky has, from the very beginning, tried to find a way to restart the peace process and has been interested in finding new solutions to break out the deadlock that has existed. And it is possible that they had a conversation about that as well. I don't think, as we talked earlier, that Biden in any way suggested that it was time for Ukraine to think about giving up any territory.
Do we know exactly how many U.S. troops are in Ukraine as we speak?
I've only seen reporting. I think there are about 150 U.S. Special Forces and others who are conducting training. There are other NATO countries who have conducted training. So one of the reason why, by the way, these troops are there is because of what happened in 2014 when Putin invaded Ukraine. After that, there was a interest by the United States and NATO allies to help bolster Ukraine's capacity for self-defense, and the training has been ongoing. Importantly, of course, as well, Ukraine sent forces to Iraq. It sent forces to Afghanistan. It's been a very good partner for NATO countries and for the United States. It has suffered casualties in those conflicts. And every country should have a right to defend itself. And we have a right to help a country like Ukraine to defend itself if it were to be attacked. And we do that through training and providing equipment.
So how long can this standoff go on? Now, I can remember other situations where the U.S. had sent in troops, just a few, 100, 150, to do training, to be a presence. And lo and behold, the number increases and increases and increases. And before you know it, the U.S. is in a full-fledged combat effort against, in this case, Russia.
Yeah, I don't see that happening here. And of course, we have been in these situations, Vietnam probably the most prominent example of let's send a few more advisors and a few more advisors. I think the difference in this case is that the United States is as interested in avoiding a military confrontation with Russia as I think Russia is in avoiding a military confrontation with the United States. And under those circumstances, and having already said that we would not send U.S. troops to defend Ukraine even if it were attacked, I don't think this natural sort of accretion of military capability it is likely to happen, in part because we knew what happened in Vietnam. What I do see is I think the capabilities and weapons that may continue to be sent to Ukraine are likely to become more sophisticated and more able. Already the Turks have been selling armed drones to the Ukrainians, and I think as long as there's this kind of military confrontation that we're seeing, countries are going to be willing to help the Ukrainians defend themselves.
So if you could read Putin's mind right now, what's he thinking? Is he thinking, well, the U.S. is threatening these serious sanctions, including financial ones. The U.S. is threatening to send more equipment, all kinds of threats. But Putin's not a man who stands down very easily. What do you think?
I think he is driven by the need to control Ukraine. The problem that Putin has is not NATO. It's the independence of Ukraine. And as long as Ukraine is independent and acts independently and seeks to align more closely with the West, with the European Union, with NATO, he will see that as the principal threat. And he will try to use whatever means he has to weaken the resolve of Kiev to act independently and certainly in a way that aligns it more with the West. And we don't know where his breaking point is. We don't know whether at what point he decides that that enough is enough and he will use military means to, frankly, prevent Ukraine from continuing to move in this direction. All accounts, the intelligence community in the United States thinks that everything he's doing is to prepare the possibility for a military invasion. The U.S. keeps on saying that he has not made a decision, which also means, which is likely to be true, but he is putting in place, really for the first time, with regard to Ukraine, all the instruments necessary for a very large-scale military operation. And as a result, I think it is extremely important that the U.S. and its allies underscore two fundamental things. One, that we continue to support in whatever ways we can, short of direct military intervention ourselves, the independence of Ukraine and its capacity to defend itself, or at the very least, its capacity to inflict major costs on Russians if they do invade. And the second point to make is that the cost to Russia in the end of moving forward militarily are going to be significantly greater than any benefit it may think they were going to get from it. That's what we need to convince Putin of. Do we want to find a safe way, face-saving way out, an off-ramp for Putin to say, okay, I got what I want? Well, one thing he wanted to have a conversation with Putin, with President Biden. He got that. The second thing he wants is maybe some conversation with the United States about the future of European security. And the U.S. is willing to do that, provided that all the allies are part of that conversation, too. There's been, by the way, a little bit of a dust-up over this, because President Biden said the other day that it would be the U.S. and four NATO allies, and I think he just misspoke there. And so there's a worry that by some NATO allies that he would have a discussion with the Russians about European security without all Europeans there. My conversations with folks in both the White House and the State Department is no. If there is a conversation about the future of European security, it will involve all of the Europeans, because after all, it's their security, as well as the United States. And we've had those discussions before. I had them when I was ambassador at NATO. That doesn't mean that you give in to Putin. But if you have that discussion and Putin can say, see, I have this big discussion, now I can pull my troops back, I think that's a price worth paying.
Do we have intelligence indicating how the Russian people themselves are feeling about Putin's actions?
So we know from his annexation of Crimea that that was extraordinarily popular. I mean, he probably hit the highest popularity ratings in the immediate aftermath of doing that. He milked it for everything possible. And there's little doubt that a confrontation with Ukraine in and of itself helps him at home. It strengthens nationalist feelings. There is a sense, because of the deep propaganda that he and his machine are using inside Russia. There's a sense among Russians that a lot of people in Ukraine, Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, are being attacked and need to be defended. And so I think in that sense, this helps him at home. However, that assumes there's very little cost to any action to the Russians. And it's one thing to have a crisis of this kind in which no people are dying, or at least none beyond the continued fighting and dying that's happening in eastern Ukraine and has been happening now with Russian support for 8 years. But if large numbers of young Russian boys come home in coffins, we know, including from the interventions in Syria, and even in Ukraine after the intervention and annexation of the invasion and annexation of Crimea, that support starts to drop. So one reason to support the Ukraine's capacity for self-defense is to make sure that the Russians know that the cost of an invasion is going to be high, and that he, Putin, knows that he may have to defend those actions in front of Russian mothers who have lost their sons. And Russian mothers are just like every other mother. Losing sons is something that changes perspective very quickly on what, whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. So I think the crisis helps him. Whether a war helps him is a different matter.
How long do you think this is going to continue without resolution?
So I think the whole issue of Russian-Ukrainian crisis is going to go on for quite a long time, and months, if not years. It's already gone on for 8 years, and in some ways it's gone on for 30 years. But the military confrontation has gone on for 8 years. I don't see that ending anytime soon, unfortunately. I hope maybe we have a new diplomatic posture and we can end it. But I don't see Putin giving up Crimea, for example. And I don't think this crisis can end without Ukraine reestablishing full sovereignty over Crimea. So this is going to go on for a long while. The current high-level crisis, I think we will know within months. It's unlikely that Putin can maintain the high-level military posture that he has now past the winter. He's clearly looked at the political situation. I think he thinks that Biden is weak politically, therefore won't do anything. He has the French elections, which are in April and May. You have a new German government that just this week got to power. And I think he's seeing an opening here. It is the responsibility of the United States and others to say that he's mistaken on misjudging the weakness of the West, and that the West is prepared to do what it can to increase the cost on Russia.
Ivo Dolder, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Diane, to be with you. Great to see you and great to talk to you.
That was Ivo Dolder, president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He served as U.S. ambassador to NATO from 2009 to 2013. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.